Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, the Clean Water Act, Approved Jurisdictional Determinations, and Judicial Review Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 31st, 2016, the Supreme Court decided United States Army Corps of Engineers v. Hawks Co. Inc. Hawks Co. applied to the Army Corps of Engineers for a Clean Water Act permit to begin extracting peat from wetlands in northern Minnesota it was preparing to purchase. After attempting to discourage the purchase and initiating various administrative processes, the Corps ultimately issued an approved jurisdictional determination, asserting that the wetland contained waters of the United States, thereby creating a substantial barrier to development by Hawks. Hawks filed suit in federal district court to challenge the approved JD, arguing that it conflicted with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. The district court dismissed the suit on the grounds that the approved JD was not a final agency action, as defined by the Administrative Procedure Act, and therefore not yet subject to judicial review. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit reversed that judgment and remanded the case, holding that an approved JD did constitute final agency action ripe for judicial review. The question before the Supreme Court was whether the United States Army Corps of Engineers' determination that the property at issue contains waters of the United States protected by the Clean Water Act constitutes final agency action for which there is no other adequate remedy in a court. It is therefore subject to judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. By a vote of 8-0, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Eighth Circuit. Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court, which held that an approved JD is a final agency action judicially reviewable under the Administrative Procedure Act. The Chief Justice's majority opinion was joined by Justices Kennedy, Thomas Breyer, Alito, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Kennedy filed a concurring opinion, in which Justices Thomas and Alito joined. Justice Kagan also filed a concurring opinion. Justice Ginsburg filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have Mark Miller, who is Managing Attorney, Atlantic Center, Pacific Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Miller.
The U.S. Supreme Court decided today unanimously to rule in favor of Hawks Company, which was Pacific Legal Foundation's client. I am a second chair on the case with Reed Hopper, who was first chair. Pacific Legal Foundation is a nonprofit organization that represents landowners and other individuals pro bono. And so in this case, we got involved at the Eighth Circuit level. And so let me tell you a little bit about the case, and then I'll talk about the opinion. So for background, for more than 40 years, landowners really have had no meaningful way to challenge a wrongful application of the Clean Water Act to their land. And that changed today when the unanimous U.S. Supreme Court ruled that landowners have the right to challenge federal claims of jurisdiction in a court of law. The Clean Water Act authorizes the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate, quote unquote, navigable waters, which these agencies interpret to mean virtually all waters in the United States and much of the land. Such waters, quote unquote, are subject to complete federal control. They can't be disturbed without a federal permit. This puts landowners at the mercy of the federal government. In this case, a family-owned business in Minnesota known as the Hawks Company sought to harvest peat moss for landscaping, and they were going to be harvesting it from peat bogs that were nearby other properties where they harvesting peat. The Corps claimed jurisdiction over the property as federally regulated wetlands, even though a Corps reviewing officer, when Hawks Company appealed that decision, even though that reviewing officer had found that there was no federal jurisdiction over the land. He had found the JD, as we call it in the parlance, to be erroneous. Nevertheless, when he reversed the JD and said, no, Army Corps, you don't have jurisdiction here, the Corps said, yes, we do. And so at that point, Hawks and the family that owns the Hawks Company was in basically an impossible position. And really all landowners who were in that similar place are in an impossible position. They can either abandon the use of the land at a great loss. They can alternatively seek a federal permit, which in this case, the Corps had let them know they were going to openly opposed to, and spend a couple hundred thousand dollars trying to get that permit that, of course, the Corps had made clear they didn't want them to get. Or they could have proceeded in the face of the jurisdictional determination without federal approval, rolling the dice that the Corps would be wrong, that if the Corps went after them for discharging into what the Corps said was federally controlled wetlands, and they went to court at that point, that they would get a judge to say, after they were being fined to the tune of $37,500 a day, they, and facing potential criminal prosecution, that at that point they could get a judge to say, no, this is not federal wetlands, Corps, you don't have jurisdiction. Well, Hawks Company didn't want to do any of those three things. They rather wanted to simply go into court immediately, not discharge, not seek a permit, and not just abandon the land. Instead, they wanted to go to court and have a judge review the administrative record and say, yes, the administrative appellate official in the Corps was correct. There was no jurisdiction here. Or no, the Corps is right. You're going to have to get a permit. But they wanted their day in court. But the problem was that since the Clean Water Act's inception, every court to have considered this matter, including the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, had held that landowners did not have the right to contest Corps jurisdiction. That was true even if the landowner could prove the Corps was wrong. For 40 years, the Corps had had the power to federalize any parcel of land with standing or flowing water without any real accountability. As my colleague Reed Harper has said, and Reed was the first chair on the case who argued Hawks, and of course, savoring his victory. And he also argued Rapanos about a decade ago. As he said, it's hard to conceive a regulatory regime with greater potential for abuse. We won at the Eighth Circuit, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers petitioned the Supreme Court for review and to accept review of the case. And interestingly, and I have to think was unusually, we, on behalf of Hawks Company, agreed and said, yes, U.S. Supreme Court, you should take the case for review because you need to create a national rule here. And one of the reasons, of course, we were zealously representing our client's interests here. We thought that the court would take the case. But at the same time, we had a companion case at the Fifth Circuit that we had taken a petition up on called Bell Company. And then Kent Recycling at the Supreme Court. This was a couple of litigants at the Fifth Circuit. We had taken a petition up just a few months before the court took theirs up, and from the Hawks decision, we had taken our petition up in the Fifth Circuit. The court had denied it. We then moved for rehearing because the denial came right before the Eighth Circuit made its conflicting decision with the Bell Company case. And so we took the position of, we asked for rehearing and said, there's now a circuit split. The court then sat on Bell Company while Hawks, after the court accepted Hawks, and so Bell Company, we expect, I don't think I've seen it, but Bell Company will be granted, vacated, and remanded, and the Fifth will be told they were wrong. So anyway, we argued that the court should take the case to set a nationwide precedent that would benefit all landowners, public and private, and today the court upheld the Eighth Circuit decision, granting landowners their day in court to challenge federal overreaching under the Clean Water Act. We would call this a long-awaited victory for property rights, fundamental fairness, and the rule of law. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of the case and how we got to today. We had oral argument in the case on March 30th. We were optimistic after the oral argument that we had a good chance of success here. The questioning was very interesting, and some of the questioning clearly leads into the opinions we got today. As I said earlier, the case was decided unanimously, but there are a number of opinions. There's a majority decision for seven of the justices, and then Ginsburg concurred in the result. We had walked out of the court that day thinking that our best day was going to be 7-1 with Justice Kagan as the dissenter, but in fact, she signed on to the majority opinion. So let me get into the opinions. So Chief Justice Roberts wrote for seven justices, and of course Justice Ginsburg concurred in that result. Justice Kennedy wrote concurrence on behalf of himself, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas. Justice Kagan wrote for herself in a concurrence, and Justice Ginsburg wrote her own concurrence. Roberts said that he felt that a jurisdictional determination, and writing for the court, the seven justices felt that this was a case that met the Bennett versus Speer two prongs analysis that gets you into court from an administrative decision in the sense that it was a final decision, and from that final decision, legal consequence flowed. He explained how even the agencies themselves call the jurisdictional determination final, and said that the agency couldn't even argue that a negative, what we call a negative JD, which means the agency, the Corps has said that your property doesn't contain federal wetlands. The agency had admitted that that was final because you have 5 years to then use your land without fear that the agency will turn around and prosecute you. And since that negative JD clearly had legal consequence, the other side of the coin, a positive JD, if you will, as we have here, also had legal consequence, also was final. And then, of course, legal consequences flow. This part of this decision, I think, is very important for all litigators who litigate against federal agencies, because his point here was that, like other precedents where the court has said, when you look for legal consequence, we're not looking for angels dancing on the head of a pin. We're not looking for necessarily what happened in Sackett, even though Sackett did fit legal consequence, where the Sackett, which is a precedent case we won 4 years ago, guessing many of the people on the call know that decision. The Sacketts were facing a compliance order from the EPA telling them to fix up their property that they were cleaning up because the EPA considered them to have disturbed wetlands. And so they were looking at fines of $37,500 a day or double that if they didn't immediately clean up their property and stop pushing the dirt around because the EPA said it was wetland, federal wetlands. And they didn't have a permit. In that case, the court had said unanimously that that was a legal consequence, that that astronomical fine of $37,500 a day or twice that was a legal consequence. Here, Hawk's company wasn't facing fines. They just simply couldn't do anything. If they went forward and used the property without the permit, they were looking at criminal prosecution and fines, or they had to spend money to get a permit. Or they could do nothing. But in any event, they were looking at practical consequences. There was the JD clearly had consequence. It was hard to believe that anyone could argue it didn't. And in fact, stepping back a little to when we were presenting the case, it was so hard to believe that anyone could say we didn't that unsurprisingly, nobody filed amicus briefs supporting the government's position here. There was almost, if I remember correctly, 16 amicus briefs representing 60 different either groups, states, some public agencies that are not federal. Everyone saying NFIB, Chamber of Commerce, everyone saying that clearly this has legal consequence, this has practical consequence. And Chief Justice Roberts said, yes, I agree with that. There's really no tenable argument. There's not practical consequences here. Then you had Justice Kennedy in what I think will probably become, not surprisingly, since it's Justice Kennedy, one of the most interesting and picked over parts of this decision, his concurrence. At the oral argument, he remarked that the Clean Water Act might be unconstitutional, and many commentators had picked up on that and said they found that quite interesting that it was Justice Kennedy who said that because it was his concurrence in the Rapanos decision where he sort of muddied up, if you will, pun intended, the meaning of navigable waters when he said it would be waters that have a significant nexus to interstate waters. Arguably, it was Justice Kennedy who made the Clean Water Act so hard to understand and so ambiguous that it could arguably be unconstitutional. And in fact, here he was saying at the oral argument that the Clean Water Act may be unconstitutional, and many people tied that to his Rapanos concurrence. So here he has now written a concurrence where the axe reach is, quote-unquote, notoriously unclear, as he quotes Justice Alito from Sackett, and the consequences to landowners, even for inadvertent violations, can be crushing. He says the reach and systemic consequences of the Clean Water Act remain a cause for concern. In light of, as I'm sure many of the callers know, in light of the ongoing Waters of the United States litigation, I would think that his concurrence here is going to become, it's going to make the Clean Water Act, the Waters litigation challenging last year's new interpretation of Waters United States, even more interesting. And I think that his concurrence may become a feature of that litigation. Then you had Justice Kagan. Justice Kagan concurred, like I said, surprised us. She concurred to say that the fact that the two agencies at issue here, it was the Army Corps of Engineers that makes the JD determination, but it's the EPA that also at times will make a jurisdictional determination. And there is an agreement between those two agencies that the EPA would consider itself bound by Army Corps of Engineer JDs. Solicitor General's office had argued in court that this agreement, this memorandum of agreement from the late 80s, in fact, only applied to special cases, but by its own terms, that was obviously untrue and was really the wrong note for the Solicitor General to start off with at oral argument, and Chief Justice Roberts gave him a hard time about it because he just simply read from it. And so Kagan wrote to say that it was her feeling that the memorandum of agreement is why she signed on, that because the EPA considered itself bound by the JD, this was a decision that had legal consequence. And so what she's implying there is that if the two agencies simply decide to tear up the memorandum of agreement, that maybe she then wouldn't find a JD to be appealable to federal court. Thankfully, she wrote that only for herself. There's no way to think after you read these opinions, and particularly after you read after having seen the oral argument, that a majority of the court would agree with her on that. And she obviously wrote for herself here, although Chief Justice Roberts talks about the memorandum of agreement in his majority opinion. I don't think he's saying it was a predicate to their decision. It's rather, I suspect, a bone he was throwing her to get her to sign on to the majority. And then finally, you have Justice Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg wrote a sole concurrence for herself I think Sotomayor may have joined with her in the Sackett case, where she said she thought the Sackett case was simple. The Sackett case was about a final compliance order that was clearly final, and it had legal consequence because fines were immediately imposed by way of it. And if you just read her concurrence in Sackett plainly, you would have thought her vote here was pretty simple too. And in fact, it turns out, at least if you read her concurrence, it seems it was, because she just simply says she thinks that a JD is final and it has obvious consequence. And this is a no-brainer. The memorandum of agreement between the two agencies has nothing to do with the finality or the consequence angle from her perspective. Simply put, a JD is final, consequences flow, you can appeal. Really, it would seem to me no different than what she said in Sackett for the most part. At least in my initial readings. So I think TLF is very excited, and certainly Kevin Pierce, the principal owner of Hawks Company, and his family, the Pierce family, very excited with his outcome. It does seem like a case that will redound to the benefit of other individuals and property owners who want to push back against federal government overreach because of its interpretation of the Bennett versus Speer test and the way it uses Abbott. And then another case, an old precedent called Frozen Food from the 50s. I think this case opens the door not just to Hawks Company getting into court earlier in the administrative process, but to other litigants who want to push back against federal overreach.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.